Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 159. I'm recording it on Tuesday, August 25th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 18. That's a little on the high side. Given the significant chance that we may be seeing another stock crash in the next few years, I don't think stocks offer a great value proposition today, but it's not horrible. The value proposition is much better than it was back before the stock crash. So it's much improved, but not terribly exciting at this valuation level. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title, the selection is T-Roots. The title of the podcast is The Returns Sequence That Happens to Pop Up Makes a Difference. I like bold titles for my podcast, and this one is sort of anti-bold in a deliberate way. Instead of saying, I don't know, I have one that I think is bold on the calculator, the retirement risk evaluator. The title to the lead article there is, I don't know exactly what it is. Something like, new school retirement calculator smashes safe withdrawal rate myths. I like titles like that. Or I have one for the scenario surfer calculator. Something like news, what was it? I can't remember. It was sort of catchy, but I can't remember it. Newsflash. Timing beats rebalancing. I like titles like that. That say something. The bolder you can make them, the better, as long as they're true. They have to be true. If they're not true, you've failed to keep your promise with your reader. But if they're true, you want to make them as strong as you can make them. I come from journalism. I've got journalism in my blood, and that's the way I look at it. Headless body and topless bar. That one was a famous one from one of those New York tabloids. I remember walking down the street in Washington and seeing that one in the newsstand, and I've hardly ever read it. The only tabloid I've ever picked up was Philadelphia Daily News. I would pick it up for the sports scores in the old days, and I was tempted to pick that one up. I just said that one's so good, I've got to buy it. I mean, I'm not going to read it, but I just got to buy it. They just deserve my quarter. I didn't, but I thought about it. But this one is sort of tame. The returns sequence that happens to pop up makes it, I don't say is life and death, is the most important thing you need to know. It makes a difference. Oh, well, yeah, that's interesting, Rob. Makes a difference. Big deal. Makes a difference. Who cares? Well, I think that's accurate. I have to live with my other podcast titles. And one of the earlier ones, not too long ago, was something along the lines of only valuations matter. Everything else is priced in. Well, if you're going to say only valuations matter, you can't say that the return sequence makes a big difference or makes a huge difference anyway. You can't say both things. Valuations, most of the first 158 podcasts deal with valuations, some aspect of the valuations question. That's the great missing link in our understanding of investing today. So I focus on that. But it's not quite true that it's the only thing that matters. There are a few other little things. And the pattern of the returns, the return sequence does matter. And so I thought I should do, and I'm studying this more with the help of John Walter Russell. He's my partner in development of the calculators. John is an amazing resource for the Retire Early and Indexing Discussion Board communities. John's website is early-retirement-planning-insights.com. A wealth of information, and none of the stuff I talk about on the podcast would be possible without John's research. We don't let Rob near the numbers. Please. Please, people. Some of these goons, they're always trying tricks. And they'll say, oh, you know, Rob is the one who did that calculator. Well, no, that's not true. Maybe Rob came up with the jazzy title for it. But Rob does not. We don't let him near the numbers. It's rule number one. Don't let Rob near the numbers. So we don't. We don't do that. That's John's thing. John's a numbers guy. Extraordinaire. And lately I've been exploring this aspect because we've done the valuations. I mean, not that we've done everything, but we've spent a lot of time on valuations. And every now and then, you know, when you're involved in a big learning process, and that's what this seven-year debate has been, the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate, it's been a learning process, and it's like the unpeeling of an onion. You start, this is why I feel so sad sometimes for the experts. You know, I always put the word experts in quotes, and I think people feel that I'm digging at them, you know. And it's not intended as a dig. It's intended to let people know they're not really experts. They may think they are. Other people may think they are, but they're not. And the reason I know they're not is because I didn't think I was any expert, but I thought I knew a few things about investing before this debate. You start down the debate and you find that just about everything you thought you knew was wrong. Just about everything is upside down. So forget about having been an expert. I won't call myself an expert today. But I won't call these other people experts either. We all need to learn together. We need a national debate on the mistakes we made in the development of the passive investing model and on the development of a new model to replace it, which I call rational investing. But I feel sad sometimes for the experts because they don't know what they're missing out on. What's going on, I believe, I'm getting a little off track, but I promise I'll keep this short, but I believe what's going on, it seems clearer and clearer all the time, is that there's a lot of institutional resistance to learning. The theory is, the idea is, you know, I've done this calculator, or I've done this study, or I've written this book, and, you know, I don't want to have to rewrite my book. I don't want to have to rejigger my calculator, so I'm not going to admit any big mistakes. I'm just going to keep, and if we all stick together, we've all been promoting passive investing. If we all stick together, nobody can make us make any changes, and, you know, if anybody tries, we'll just drum them out, you know, just ban them, whatever we have to do. We're just going to keep doing the same old thing here. That's all. I mean, I really think that's all that's going on. Pathetic as that is, it's pathetic. It's really pathetic. But that's the deal. And of course, they don't understand, you know. If you're not willing to look at the evidence, you're not going to understand. So because they don't want to make changes, they don't want to know what the evidence says. So they just refuse to look at it. And then if anybody says, well, why don't you make changes? They say, I didn't know there was anything wrong. I didn't understand. I don't want to understand. They don't want to change their calculators. They don't want to change their books. But I feel sorry for them because it's exciting. Learning is exciting and it's fun. Aside from the fact that the advice you end up giving, if you learn the ABCs of a subject you're talking about, actually can help people instead of destroying their lives. Yeah, that's sort of a side thing. I mean, even from a purely selfish perspective, it's fun. So in that respect, I feel sorry for the experts, but somehow I got started on that. Oh, I think I was saying that it's the unpeeling of an onion. This is what we've been doing for 7 years. We started with this simple thing. The old school safe withdrawal rate studies got the numbers wrong. Now, you know what? How did that happen? You know, why is there such resistance to acknowledging it? You know, what are the implications? And then it just keeps expanding and expanding. We keep going and going and going. And but every now and then, the way you learn is, you know, you find this question you want to learn about and you drill, and then, you know, you pick up your drill and you walk over, you know, to a different spot, and then you drill there for a while. And then after the ground, you know, gets sort of beaten up, you know, you go to another part of the field and you explore somewhere else. So lately, last few weeks, I've been thinking about this question of the return sequence. And I've talked about it, not on the podcast, but I mean, years ago, John Walter Russell and I, I've been posting at boards for over seven years, and John and I have been exchanging emails for a long time, and we've talked about return sequences before. But what's really cool is that, you know, when, you know, the first time you talked about it, you didn't know a lot of things. So you're sort of shooting in the dark, and then you learn something, you know, 3 years later. And now if you circle back, you can figure out the first thing, because now you've got the pieces of the puzzle you need to make it all click. And I think, frankly, this is what makes it hard sometimes to explain all these things to newcomers, because you can't go through 7 years of history in 50 words. You know, you sort of had to be there. Now, I obviously can't ask people to live through 7 years, and I wouldn't relive it again. I asked my mother. I hope that you won't think this is unkind, but you know, my mother is 92 years old. She's up there. And the last time we were visiting, I asked her, and you know, I don't know. I saw my mother, and she's obviously, you know, she's independent, but she's you know, she's got a lot of weaknesses. And my boy was there, who's 7, you know, and of course they have unlimited energy, and my other boy 9, and they're running around and whatever, being goofballs. And the thought just came to me, and I said, would you, if you had the choice — this has nothing to do with investing, but I don't care. It's important to me. And I said, if, you know, if an angel came down from the sky and you had a chance to live your whole life over again, you know, start at age 7 again and just go forward and you know, but you would not have the knowledge you have today. So you would make the same mistakes. I mean, not necessarily exactly the same, but you would make the same number of mistakes. So you'd have the pains and the joys of life all over again. Would you want to do that? And she said no, and my wife said no, and you know, I think the right answer is no. I think that's — when my mother says it and my wife says it, that's probably the right answer. And I sort of feel that, but I don't know. You know, there's a thing where you want to hold on to it. So, you know, I'm 52, and I don't know. You know, you look at the boys and you say, boy, I'd sure like to have that energy. You know, I'd like to have that back. You know, and they get excited, you know, about the most simple things. On the other hand, you think of, you know, obviously you go through the course of life. You have some wonderful, wonderful days where these great things happen. You have these other days where sad things happen. And you say, would I want to live through it again? Or is the point that you go through it one time and, you know, then you go on to the next thing, which I believe there's a next thing. I know that's controversial, but that's my belief. So I think I think if you're at peace, you accept that it's a one time. But I'm not going to say that I'm there. I think that's the right answer. I can give the right answer, but I can't feel it 100%. I do feel it to some extent. To some extent, I feel like I wouldn't want to do this over again. So the reason that came up is I was talking about the 7 years, the debate. And I said, I wouldn't want to do it again. I've learned things during the 7 years that I get into this because of the learning. That's why I do this. I mean, you know, I do it for lots of reasons. I do it for money. I want to build a business out of it. And, you know, so I do it for lots of reasons. And I have, you know, I do it for friendships I form. But of all the reasons I do it, I think the number one reason is learning. I love to learn. I think it's the one thing God gave me that is a real strength. I'm not the smartest guy. I don't say that ever. But if you ask me, is there anyone you know who has a thirst for learning that matches mine? I know there are people out there who do, but I don't personally know them. Of people I personally know, I'll stand up to anybody in my thirst for learning. I think that's something God gave me, and, you know, some other things he didn't give me. And so you have to go to your strengths. And so the learning experience has been just extraordinary. It's just I can't even describe it. It's just off the charts. Amazing. It's just amazing. I can't believe the things I say on these podcasts. I'm like, who were you to say this? But the answer is John Bogle hasn't participated in the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate. So what's he know? You know, quite frankly, no dig intended. But so the learning experience has been wonderful, but I wouldn't live through it again. It's been, it's been an awful thing to see the horror. So anyway, but my point was that as you go deeper, you learn new things, and then you circle back, and things that didn't make sense before suddenly make sense, and wow, is that a great feeling. And so lately, the last month or two, I've been focusing a little more on the return sequence, and I think I understand things about it that I didn't understand before, and so I want to talk about it a little bit, but I don't want to suggest that the return sequence is all important. It's not as important as valuations. It's not even close. The most important thing you need to know to become an effective stock investor is how valuations affect long-term returns. And so if you're only going to listen to one podcast, this is the wrong one. Stop. Go back. Find a different one. But if I was on, I don't know, I was going to, you know, think, if I was only going to listen to one, what would it be? I don't know. I have a list there at the front page of the blog, my favorite podcast. So you could look there, look at that list. But there's one that I liked a lot on, when stock losses are real and when stock losses are not real, something like that. That would be a good one to start with, to know the difference between a real loss and a temporary loss. That would help a lot. But there's a lot that you could start with as the first one. Market timing, what works and what doesn't, that would be a good one to start with. But I wouldn't start with this one. But given that 100, there's like 150 of them that deal with valuations, I think it makes sense to have one of them dealing with the return sequence, which is not totally insignificant. And I'm going to make a case here that it is somewhat significant. It's worth understanding. It's worth knowing about. The return sequence does matter. All right. Now, the return sequence, there's a great irony in return sequence. What the return sequence is, I guess I should define my terms before I start. Return sequence is the pattern, okay? Just say that you know that over the next 10 years, the return on stocks is going to be 5% real, annualized. Say you know that. Angel comes down from heaven, tells you. There's all kinds of ways you can generate a 5% real return annualized over 10 years. It could be, you could have 5% every year. That would do it. But it could also be, loss of 10%, loss of 10%, loss of 10%, gain of 40%. There's all kinds of mixes that will come to 5% annualized. And so the question we're talking about in this podcast is which mix is best? And I'm not going to get into detail. I'm not sure I'm ready to do that, but I'm going to give an overview of why that matters. And then there probably will be follow-up podcast in which I'll go into more detail, at least one more. But that's the question we're looking at. And that matters. And a lot of, I think a lot of people don't even know that matters. They don't even understand that. I mean, I'm not being critical, but I wish that, the way we educate people about stock investing just frustrates me, because this stuff, some of it is so important, and there's so much nonsense in the, what's the Dow going to do next month? That's all they ever talk about. It's such a big waste of time. Nobody knows. God bless John Bogle. At least he's got that one right. Big waste of time. And we could be spending it teaching people about stuff that matters. And there's a very, the fact that valuations matter, that's, of course, a source of endless frustration, but the return sequence matters. And so you should know this. It's not essential. You could do fine without knowing anything about the return sequence. But given that your retirement money is at stake, I think it does make sense to spend an hour listening to a podcast and learn the basics. So, and you don't see much on it. Not much else on it out there. Now, the big breakthrough in our understanding of how the return sequence matters is the dreaded old school safe withdrawal rate studies. You hear me talk about the old school safe withdrawal rate studies all the time. I am the person who discovered the errors, the analytical errors in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. I reported what I learned on a Motley Fool discussion board back in May of 2002, and that set off a nuclear reaction, the most positive reaction we've ever seen on any money-related discussion on the internet, and also the most negative, the most hate-filled. And it's just this weird combination. And that's generated all the material on investing at my site relates to that series of discussions, the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate Debate. But, and of course, so people tend to think of me as the guy who doesn't like the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. I've sort of got this, you know, rep. But it's not fair. It's not an accurate characterization. I love the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, and I've said so many, many times. And William Bernstein, in his book, The Four Pillars of Investing, William Bernstein points out the errors in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. He does it in a sort of cagey way. He doesn't want to be quoted, but he tells us in that book that the old school studies get the numbers wrong by 2 percentage points. It's a pretty darn big deal. And yet he says in his book that the old school studies are breakthrough research. That's a quote, breakthrough research. And I said during these discussions hundreds of times, not once, that I agree with Bernstein. Those studies are breakthrough research. And when John Graney did a soapbox report, soapbox.com was a website that's now shut down, and he did a report of his safe withdrawal rate study, I gave it a 5-star customer review on grounds that the old school studies are breakthrough research. They're wrong. They get the numbers wrong. They're dangerous. I want them corrected. Okay, all that's true. That's why people think of me as a critic. But critic that I may be, the old school studies were breakthrough research. They advanced the ball considerably. And if you understand what the old school studies showed us, you understand something very important about the return sequence. And sadly, the old school studies are cited all the time, but very few people seem to understand what they say, or the implications anyway of what they say. You know, people get it that they say a 4% withdrawal is safe. That people get. But they don't understand where it comes from, and they don't understand the implications. And the richness of the learning experience of the old school studies comes from understanding those implications. You have to understand what these studies actually show, because it's shocking. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the old school studies, but I am going to spend a little time to point out what they say. Here's the history. There are basically three levels of understanding of safe withdrawal rates. There's the what you might call the caveman understanding, which is the understanding that what's his name? Peter Lynch? Yeah, Peter Lynch, right? Peter Lynch at Fidelity. Peter Lynch doesn't sound quite right somehow. I don't know if I have it written down somewhere. I know his name was Lynch, but I don't know. I don't think I have it written down. Seems that my head is saying Peter Lynch. And he was at Fidelity. You know, famous guy. Everybody else knows his name. All the experts could tell you in 10 seconds. But Lynch, you know, he ran the Magellan Fund. Peter Lynch, I think it was. And anyway, he did an article once saying it's a caveman understanding, but it's not at all dumb. I mean, what he said is totally plausible. What Peter Lynch said was, if you retire and you have a certain stock portfolio, we all know, this is widely known, that, you know, you often hear people say the return on stocks is 10% a year. Well, that's adding in inflation. But when you don't add in inflation, when you just take the real return, the long-term real average real return on stocks is 6.5% real. 6.5% real. If you average that up to, you know, you could average it up to 7. So Peter Lynch was talking in shorthand. He said 7% real. Now, we all accept that that's true. It's a fact. You know, look at the data, you'll see. Okay. So Peter Lynch says in an article, he said, if if stocks return 7% real per year, and you're planning to retire, and you have $1 million, how much can you take out every year? And it sounds like the answer's easy, doesn't it? Take out 7% real. You know, easy peasy. 6.5 if you want it to be really accurate. Which is $70,000 a year. Or if you want it to be accurate, $65,000 a year. $65,000 a year. And it all seems so simple, doesn't it? The return is 6.5. You take out 6.5. What do you need studies for? Well, the old school safe withdrawal rate studies are the studies that showed that Peter Lynch was wrong. And Peter Lynch, to his credit, when this was pointed out to him, he acknowledged that he was wrong. He should be a hero for that, because that's unheard of in the investing field. I don't think anybody's ever admitted they were wrong since Peter Lynch. So my hat's off to him. But Peter Lynch just gave a common sense understanding, and he wrote an article saying, you know, if you got $1 million, you retire, you can live on $65,000, and your portfolio would never be depleted. If you're earning 6.5% real, you can take out $65,000 a year, and you know, at the end of 30 years, if you retire at 65, when you're 95 and you're close to death, you still have that $1 million in real terms. You'd have more than $1 million because of inflation, but in inflation-adjusted terms, you'd still have $1 million to pass on to your kids. Well, the old school study said no, that's not right. What the old school studies say is, it's not right. Volatility affects, or I should say, the return sequence. The return sequence that happens to show up affects how much you can take out. This is counterintuitive, and it's tremendously important. Because stocks are so volatile. If stocks were not volatile, the fact that the return sequence matters wouldn't be that big a deal. It'd be sort of a little thing. But stocks are very volatile, extremely volatile. It's the only downside, really. I mean, stocks are a great, you know, the return, the 6.5 real is just mouthwatering. So they're a great asset. But the volatility tricks people in 100 different ways. And one of the ways it tricks people is people hear 6.5 and they think like Peter Lynch did, and he was the manager of Fidelity's or Magellan. He's not exactly a dummy. You would think you could take out $65,000 a year, and you would think that at the end of 30 years, you'd still have $1 million. But it's not true. And I'll give you an example that I hope will explain it, you know. Help it to click for you. Say that you have $1 million in your portfolio and you retire at age 65. And well, in the worst price drop we've experienced so far was the price drop in the late 1920s, early 1930s. The P10 level then went up to 33, which was the worst on record. Until the late 90s, where we got up to 44. And when we got up to 33, remember, anything above 25 is insane. Anything above 20 is dangerous. When we got up to 33, we saw an 80% price drop, real. 80% real price drop. Didn't stay in effect all that long, but that was at the low point. It was an 80% drop, real. So, if you had started with $1 million, let's say that you know you retired in 29 just before the crash, and I don't know how far in it was when it was down 80. I don't know the answer, but let's say 3 years. And you're taking out 7,000. You're following Peter Lynch's advice. You're taking out 7,000 a year on $1 million portfolio because you think that's safe. Sounds like it's safe. Now at the end of 3 years, your portfolio is down to 20,000. You've lost 200,000. If you had $1 million, if you had $1 million and you lost 80%, you're down to 200,000. But you're taking out 70,000 a year. So in the first 3 years, you took out 210,000. So your portfolio, the price drop brought it down to 200,000, and now you're taking out 210,000. Well, guess what? Your retirement just went bust in 3 years. That's how safe the Peter Lynch approach is. It's not safe at all. You see, the trouble here is, if you never had to take any money out, you had an 80% loss. It sounds horrible. But stocks are such a strong long-term asset class that after that 80% loss, they were going to recover it. Stocks were going to recover. And if this were all done in some mythical world where you didn't have to take any money out to, you know, pay for the electric bill, you would get all that money back, plus 7%, annualized for 30 years. It would all come back to you in the long run. This is one of the big flaws with passive investing. They always look at what happens at 30 years, but they overlook what happens at 3 years, and 5 years, and 10 years, and 15 years, and 20 years. And you got to look at all of the time periods. You can't just look at 30 years out. That doesn't work. That's dangerous thinking. So, you never get to your 30 if you don't get past year 3. And if you take 70,000 out a year, like Peter Lynch was saying you could, and you do this and you happen to retire at a time of high valuations, there's a good chance you're never going to make it to year 30. Good chance you'll never make it to year 10 or year 15. So, the whole point of the safe withdrawal rate studies was, instead of just saying, you know, we're going to take the average long-term return and call that our withdrawal rate, let's look at all of the sequences that we've seen in the historical record, and let's find out what the highest withdrawal rate is that worked in every one of those sequences. And that's where this famous 4% rule comes from. If you look at all the sequences and you look for the highest withdrawal rate that worked, it's 4%. If you went to 4.1, there was at least one sequence in which that retirement failed within 30 years. So 4% is safe, but nothing higher than 4% is safe. Now the flaw in that analysis is we've only had two of those sequences in the modern times. In the late 1920s, we've had a lot of sequences, but we've only had two where stocks were at insanely dangerous price levels. So from 1996 through 2008, stocks were at insanely dangerous price levels. Well, if you want to know what's safe at insanely dangerous price levels, you don't want to be looking at all these historical sequences where stocks were not at insanely dangerous price levels, because they don't tell you what you need to know. Stocks are, you know, 10 times more dangerous when they're at those prices. So you've got to compare apples to apples. And there's only two apples in the entire historical record. There's only been two times when we went to insanely priced levels before the 90s, the third time. That we haven't seen the results of that one yet. We're still in the middle of it. We're still in the middle of the payback. And there was a fourth time, you know, way back in the early 1900s. But if you're looking at the modern record from 1924 forward, there's only two times. The late 1920s, we went to 33, P10 level 33, and the mid-1960s, I think we went to a P10 level 25 or 26. So those are the only two. And in those two, a 4% withdrawal barely worked. It barely worked by a whisker. So the question you've got to ask yourself is, if something barely worked by a whisker two times, does that mean it's safe? And it doesn't. What it means is that it's risky. The fact that it barely worked twice means there's a real good chance it's not going to work the third time. It might. It certainly means there's some chance it will work. But who knows how good that chance is? Well, the way you figure out how good the chance is, you look at the return sequence, and you see whether it was a lucky return sequence or an unlucky for retirees. And we've done that. John Walter Russell's done that. And the answer is both the return sequence we saw in the 1920s, the 1930s, and the return sequence we saw in the 1960s, 1970s, they were both slightly lucky return sequences. That is, if you look at all the return sequences that were possible in the historical record, that would be consistent with what we've seen in the historical record, what about the 4% withdrawal works in, you know, roughly 50%, a little less, you know, maybe a little less, roughly 50% of those sequences. So it's true that 4% worked, but it didn't work because it's safe. It worked because it was lucky two times. You know, you flipped a coin two times and it turned up heads two times. You know, there was about a 50% chance of a 4% withdrawal working, and two times in a row it worked. Well, that's not shocking, is it, that you flip a coin and you get heads two times? But they're saying it's safe to stake your entire retirement that heads is going to come up a third time. Who the heck knows if it is or it isn't? If we get a lucky sequence, it'll work a third time. If we get an unlucky sequence, no. You're left destitute at age 80. So I think those studies, they were a great advance, but they're dangerous as all get out. They're reckless. And I don't fault the people for making a mistake. Anyone can make a mistake, but I do fault them for not correcting it for 7 years now, since the mistake has been, you know, publicly revealed. Anyway, that's safe withdrawal rate research. But the point here is that shows you the importance of the return sequence. And we're not talking valuations here. It's valuations that made retirement dangerous in the 1920s and in the 1960s and in the 1990s. It's valuations that created the problem, that's for sure, not the return sequence. But the return sequence can determine whether your retirement makes it or not. A simple way to describe this is, you know, look at the retirement risk evaluator, the calculator at the website, and you'll see. At any PE10 level, what the calculator teaches us is that you must look at the PE10 level that applies on the day the retirement begins to know what withdrawal rate is safe. It always changes. The safe withdrawal rate is not a constant number. It's a number that varies according to valuations. But there's never one number that you know is going to work. There's always a range. So what changes is that range. The safe withdrawal rate is just defined in the literature as what works in the worst case scenario. So when you look at the range of possible withdrawal rates that might work, the bottom of that range is defined as the safe withdrawal rate. So if you look when at the top of the bubble, January of 2000, the safe withdrawal rate, the surviving withdrawal rate, the withdrawal rate that's going to work. We don't know what it is today. But we know that if stocks perform in the future, anything at all, as they always have in the past, that number is going to end up being some number between 2% and 5%. We don't know today what it is. But we know it's going to be between those two, unless something happens that's never happened before. So it's a range of 3 percentage points from 2 to 5. Now, at some other valuation level, if you go to moderate valuation levels, the range might be from 5 to 8 or from 4 to 7. It's always a range of 3 percentage points. So whenever you retire, you don't know what withdrawal rate is going to work. You can, by looking at the calculator, you can know the range of possibilities of what withdrawal rate is going to work. And then you decide how much risk you want to take on. If you want to be safe, you go with the low number because that's going to work unless we see something worse than what we've ever seen in the past. And if you want to see something, you know, risky, you move down that range. But obviously, in January of 2000, when the range was from 2% to 5%, a 4% withdrawal was high risk. There's a chance it could work, but it's high risk. It's clearly got a less than 50% chance of working. based on the historical data. So, what I'm trying to bring out here is the importance of the return sequence. When you retire, you know that it's going to be somewhere between 2 and 5. And the thing that determines that, you see, there's two factors. There's two factors in what's going to happen with your stocks. One is what valuation level applies on the day the retirement begins. And that determines what the range of possibilities is. Because if the valuation is very high, the range might be from 2% to 5%. If the valuation is very low, the range might be from 9 to 12%. If you're down at a P10 level of 7, the range is from 9% to 12%. Your safe withdrawal rate is between 9 and 12. Not your I should say your surviving withdrawal rate. The safe withdrawal rate is 9. But there's a chance that 10 could work, and there's a chance that 11 could work. There's a tiny chance that even 12 could work. So the valuation level is very, very important. At some points, the safe withdrawal rate is 2%, which means out of a $1 million portfolio, you can take $20,000 a year to live on. And at some point, it's 9, which means you can take $90,000 a year. So valuations are of huge importance. But the return sequence is not insignificant. Because the return sequence determines whether you're going to fall on the top of that sequence or at the bottom. Are you able to take out 90 or are you able to take out 120? That's determined by the return sequence, not by the valuation level. These are different factors. Valuation is by far the dominant one, the most important one. But the return sequence could be life and death. I mean, you know, it's sort of like they say baseball's a game of inches. Well, you can say, you know, the most important thing is pitching, and next is hitting, and next is fielding, but sometimes a game is determined by the strength of your pinch hitters. Now, not the most important thing to have good pinch hitters, but it can decide a game. Well, the return sequence can decide whether your retirement succeeds or fails, and of course, this all applies outside of retirement as well. We study it in the retirement context. That's how we learn this stuff, but it applies, you know, in the accumulation stage as well. It's just that in the same principle applies. The difference is you're not taking money out every year, so it's not quite as dire if you mess up. And you're still working, so you have time to recover. But the same principle applies, that the valuation level determines what your long-term return is going to be. The return sequence, there's always a range. Whenever I tell you the most likely 10-year return, I usually give the number in the middle, the most likely number. But there's always a range of possibilities. If you look at the calculator, you'll see this. Well, it's the return sequence that determines where on that range you end up. So that's not insignificant. It does matter. It does matter. The return sequence that happens to pop up makes a difference. Now, I'm going to make a claim here, and I don't know if it's true. I think it's true. I did a podcast not too long ago called, I don't recall the exact title. It was something like, I don't know, stock losses are better than stock gains, something like that, or price drops are better than price increases, something like that. Counterintuitive, but true. I won't go through the whole logic, but the basic idea there is, say that you know over the next 10 years that the return on stocks is going to be 5% real, annualized. Are you better to have, in the first year, a 10% gain, or are you better to have a 10% loss? The answer is you're better to have a 10% loss, and that throws people. But the reason is, if you're going to have a 5% annualized return at the end of 10 years, you're going to make up any loss. And see, that's the right way to look at it, because the long-term return of stocks is set by the productivity of the U.S. economy. The return sequence doesn't affect that. So the fact that you have a 10% loss in the first year doesn't mean you're going to have a loss overall. It's just a temporary thing. So if you consider the 5% gain locked in because that's what the economy is going to deliver, then you're better to have a loss in the first year Because if you're buying stocks every year, that means you're buying stocks at a lower price. And you're still going to get the 5% annualized return at the end of 10 years, but you're going to get your stocks at a lower price than if there had been a 10% gain in the first year. So you end up better off. I have a whole podcast on that. And John and I are working on a calculator that will explore this in greater depth. And I think we're going to call it the buy and hold reality checker. And I think it's important because most stock investors are rooting for price gains. And I think they're rooting for the wrong thing. We'd all be better off with price losses. And it is counterintuitive. All valuation, I think the whole problem with the battle between passive investing and rational investing is passive investing is sort of what we want to have be true. It's the emotional appeal. But rational is what works according to the data and according to logic. But passive has emotional appeal and it has some intuitive appeal. It sort of sounds plausible, sounds right. But when you dig in, you find out, no, it's very flawed. So we all think that stock increases in stock prices are a good thing. And the reality is, no, if you have drops in stock prices in the early years of your investing career, you're much better off in the long term. So we're going to try to do a calculator that shows that effect. Well, the question we're getting at then is what kind of return sequence is better? What I'm saying is, the example I gave you, I said 10 years, 5% annualized real return. So the real return isn't changing at all. I'm not describing a valuation. You know, what I often argue is, if the P10 level is 44, your 10-year return is likely to be -1 annualized. And if your PE10 level at the starting point is 7, your 10-year annualized return is likely to be 15% real. That's the effect of valuation, which is huge. But now what I'm saying is forget valuation. Assume that the long-term return is stable. In both scenarios, only thing changes is the return sequence. That can have an effect. And the calculator will show you how much of an effect. As I say, I'm not as confident on some of these points because we're only beginning to look into this. We've sort of looked at it, but not in great depth. The valuation question, we've just, explored till our eyes are bleeding, So I feel more confident, a little less confident on this stuff. But I think it's worth putting forward. These are tentative findings, and I'd like to have other smart people jump in. Now, something we found, last year, about a year ago. I of all the findings, we've come to some amazing findings, but this is the one that most shocked me. And I just think I'd like to shout it from the rooftops, but it's hard to get people to listen today. I think some of the news that we've come up with is so good, people can't hear it. They can't let it in. It's just too good. But this news is so good. And the news is that passive investors believe that stock returns are completely unpredictable. You can't predict. That's what it means if the market's efficient. If the market is efficient, then things just sort of happen and you can never know what they are. And that's why they don't believe in changing their stock allocation, because the return is unpredictable. If it's unpredictable, well, what's the point of changing it? You just pick the allocation that makes the most sense for you and stick with it. But of course, it is predictable. And we did a test, John really did it, to find out how predictable. And statisticians have tools for this. They find the correlation between, two data points, I guess, two factors. And so we looked for the correlation between the PE10 level when you make an investment, when you buy stocks, buy an index, and the 20-year return. And we looked at you do a regression analysis and from that the statisticians can tell you how much that factor tells you about the other factor, how strong the correlation is. And the answer is the PE10 level tells you 78% of what you need to know your stock return in 20 years. that blows my mind. Because passives will tell you it's zero. You can't know anything. And that's risk as far as I'm concerned. Risk is uncertainty. So passive, the risk is 100%. You know nothing about your future return. Rational, you know 78% of what you need to know. All that matters in investing is your return. That's all that you care about. And if you're just willing to look at the data, you know it 78%. So you've eliminated 4/5 of the risk of stock investing, which I think is fantastic. That's why rational investors are so much more confident than passive investors in the long run. Now, a question that has always bothered me since we made that discovery is, well, why is it we only know, you know, I don't want to be greedy. I think it's wonderful to know 78%, but why is it we only know 78%? Why isn't it 100%? Because according to the logic of rational investing, according to the principles, it seems to me, and again, I'm not on firm ground here. I'm happy to be contradicted by other smart people, or I should say, other smart people smarter than me. Let's put it that way. But it seems to me that we should have 100% predictability, because I have another podcast where I argue, a recent one where I argue, valuations are all that matters because everything else is priced in. All the things they talk about in the newspapers that affect stock prices, you know, interest rates, you know, whether healthcare goes through, you know, Federal Reserve, I don't know, gas prices, all these things. They're all factored in to the productivity of the economy, and that's where we get the 6.5 number. So all that stuff is factored in to our calculation. It's all there, and there's nothing any of us can do about it. So my argument is just don't pay any attention to it. Just ignore it. It doesn't matter. The only way it matters is if something happens so bad that the U.S. productivity changes dramatically, so that instead of being enough to finance a 6.5% average long-term stock return, the long-term return changes. You know, if it changes to 5% or to 8%, that would obviously be a big deal. But I don't think any of us know the answer to that. But if you think you do, certainly feel free, you know, to use different numbers just to make an adjustment. But I usually work my default position is we don't know. So let's just use the 6.5, which is the historical number that's always applied. Well, everything that relates to the economy is factored into that number. So economic changes just don't matter to a rational investor. They're immaterial. In the long term, they don't matter. They all balance out. There's going to be some good ones. There's going to be some bad ones. Now, the only thing that's not factored in there is the valuation level. That's not factored in. So you have to look at P10, which of course, you know, that's what drives everything in the rational school or the valuation informed indexing school. But if the P10 level tells you everything you need to know, why isn't the P10 level, why doesn't it give you 100% predictability? Obviously, it can't give you that in a year or 5 years, because the market's not efficient in 5 years, or, you know. But at the greatest point of efficiency, at the greatest point of predictability, not efficiency, the greatest point of predictability, it's 78% predictable. And I guess it just irritates me that it's not 100. And I could be totally wrong in my explanation here. No one has verified this. I've just sort of cooked it up in my head, and I ran it past John. He didn't respond, so I don't know if that means he agrees or disagrees. Maybe he doesn't feel he knows and doesn't want to say. I just don't know. But no one has ever confirmed this, and I don't trust things that one person comes up with. So I put my confidence in this idea sort of low, maybe 40%, not even 50%. But it's a theory that I sort of like. I mean, it'd be nice if it were true. It would make all the pieces fit, but it may not be true. But my thought is, what's the other 22? Could it be that the other 22%, the missing 22%, is the effect of the return sequence? In other words, when you buy a stock or you buy an index, you buy a broad index, if you know the P10, you know what's going to happen 20 years out, except 22% is determined by the return sequence, and that's unknown. And the 22%, if that were true, it's really being determined, it's not being to be determined so much it's not being determined by the economic factors exactly, but it's being determined by the order in which they play out. In other words, certain arrangements of economic factors and also emotional factors, certain arrangements produce one return sequence and certain arrangements produce a different return sequence. Now, whether it's true that it's the missing 22% or not, I don't have much confidence. I'm curious about the idea, but I don't have a whole lot of confidence. But any way you look at it, the return sequence does matter. That much is certainly clear. So what I want to do in the remaining time is just to go over, I think I have a list of 10, but some of them I'm going to go through real quick. 10 ways in which the return sequence that happens to pop up makes a difference. One of our important findings, a very early finding, is that when you have a retirement, you can find out within 10 years whether it's going to survive or not, 30 years, with high degree of confidence. All of the retirements that fail can be known to be failures within 10 years, even if they don't fail in 10 years. Go to John's site, and he has the research on this. But what essentially happens is a retirement has to get in trouble within 10 years for it to fail. If it gets, it's really 11 years, but I round it off to 10. But if it doesn't get in trouble in 10 or 11 years, it will have built up enough that it will make it for 30. So this is very important strategically, because take somebody like John Graney. John Graney, I believe retired in 96. I'm not certain, I believe. And I don't know what his withdrawal rate was. I imagine it was 4%. And I don't know exactly what the safe withdrawal rate was in 96, but I'm fairly confident it was less than 4%. So he retired with a withdrawal rate. It wasn't the worst. It wasn't like 2000, where the safe withdrawal rate was 2%, but it was less than 4%. So he had some risk in his retirement plan. Then his retirement, I don't know his numbers, but it grew dramatically. I think the $500,000 turned into something like $3 million. Now he's had big reversals. He's probably lost something close to $1.5 million when you count 2000 forward. So maybe he's down to $1.5 million, and we may well have another stock crash, which could mean another loss of, say $800,000. He might be down to $700,000 before all this is over in real terms. But that sounds bad. I mean, to go from $3 million to $700,000 sounds bad. But he started out with $500,000. If he ends up with $700,000, he's still ahead of the game. His retirement is not going to fail as long as he's not taking out more than he was in the beginning. So the point here is he's gotten through 10 years. He had a somewhat dangerous retirement in 96, but it's now 13 years. So he's in safe territory. Now, maybe it's not 100% safe, but it's safe. It's reasonably safe. And there's a lot of people in those circumstances. People who retired in 95, the valuations were fairly high, 96, 97, 98, 99. All of those retirees potentially were in danger. When they retired, they were making dangerous retirements. But today, halfway through 2009, they're fairly safe. I can't give you the numbers. John, I think, could give you numbers, but they're at least 80% safe and probably 90%. They're in pretty darn good shape. I would guess it's close to 90% safety at this point. That's because the return sequence was favorable to them. Even if they see another crash, even if, they've seen one crash last year, and they may see another crash in another year or two or three, but those crashes were sufficiently delayed for them to get into safe territory. Well, strategically, this is very important. If you're a retiree, it gives you great comfort to know, if you live through a crash, that, see, what's going on, the dynamic here is that Yes, we may have another crash. I think the odds are we will, but that's not so bad because what that crash is going to mean, if we have another crash, is that stocks are going to be priced to deliver amazing returns in the following 10 years. So that will take those retirements will be depleted, but then they're going to have 10 years of great growth. You know, in years, say, 10 through 20 of the retirement, which means the retirement survives. The retirement ends up doing well. But if you have that huge depletion early on, you never have a chance to recover if you're withdrawing from the portfolio at the same time. It's just too much of a hit in the early years. You deplete it so low that continuing to take out the same withdrawal will ultimately cause the retirement to collapse. So that finding that it's the first 10 years of a retirement that matter most, that's a finding that is based solely on return sequence that has it has nothing to do with valuation. The fact that the retirement was dangerous has to do with valuation. But the question of whether getting through 10 years or not is enough, that's a return pattern question or a return sequence question. Point two I had is it's possible that the return sequence is the missing 22%. I've already discussed that, so there's no need to discuss that anymore. Point three was it shows by itself outside of the valuation question that losses are better than gains. Well, see, when I say losses are better than gains, that's a counterintuitive finding. Losses are better than gains for two different reasons. One, losses cause a lower valuation level, which means you'll have higher returns in the future. So losses are good from a valuations perspective, but they're good not only from a valuations perspective, they are also good from a return sequence perspective for the reason I explained earlier, that if you have losses in the early years of your investing career, you're going to be buying stocks at lower prices, which means in the end, you're better off, even if the long-term return you obtain is the same, the long-term annualized return. Because that long-term annualized return really only applies to the initial investment. But you're buying the stocks in the middle at different prices, and you're getting an edge from that. Point four, I said it affects emotional stability. See, this is something they don't like to talk about in the conventional literature, but the key to successful stock investing, I mentioned stocks are a wonderful asset class, but for one thing, volatility, which is a killer, well, the thing that causes people to sell their stocks at the wrong time is volatility. Well, that's the return sequence. If stocks delivered that 6.5 real in a steady way, and we never had 20% gain years and we never had 20% loss years, everybody would be able to hold stocks for the long run, and everybody would really get the 6.5. The reality is it's a small percentage of investors that ever gets that 6.5% return. Why? Because buy and hold is a lot harder than it looks. The stock selling industry has tried to make it sound like buy and hold is easy. And they do that because they want us to buy stocks. Buy and hold is a good idea, but it's hard. And in order to buy and hold successfully, you have to understand valuations and you have to change your allocation, your stock allocation in response to big price changes. I believe. But the point here is you do want to stick with your plan and you don't want to be selling stocks at times of low prices, and volatility is what causes you to do that. And most investors have very little appreciation of how big the volatility is. Returning to an earlier point, remember I compared Peter Lynch saying you can take out 7% and the old school studies that say 4%? Most people miss this. Think of how big a difference those two claims are. Peter Lynch was saying you could take out $70,000 a year from a $1 million portfolio every year for 30 years, and at the end of the 30 years, still have a $1 million portfolio. He was not saying to deplete your portfolio. He was saying you could take out $70,000 because the return is 7%. The old school studies are saying you can only take out 4%, $40,000, and your portfolio might be depleted to zero. That's the assumption in the old school studies, that your portfolio will be depleted to zero over those 30 years. Think of the difference. Lynch is saying $70,000 a year, portfolio's worth $1 million at the end. The old school studies are saying $40,000 a year, portfolio's worth zero. Rob Bennett is saying $20,000 a year for those who retired in January 2000, and your portfolio is only worth zero at the end of 30 years. And Rob Bennett is saying, if you retire in a year like 1982, when the P10 level is 7 or 8, you could take $90,000 a year. So look at the differences. We've got Peter Lynch saying $70,000 a year, old school study saying $40,000 a year, Rob Bennett at high valuation saying $20,000 a year, and Rob Bennett at low valuation saying $90,000 a year. 20, 40, 70, 90, which is true? You decide. But that should give you some idea of how primitive our understanding of stock investing is when you can have recognized people like Peter Lynch and the people who did these old school studies coming up with these numbers. And I'm not, you know, super famous, but I back up everything I say with data. And I've got numbers totally, Lynch's numbers are totally different from the old school numbers. The old school numbers are totally different from the new school numbers at low valuations. And all three sets are totally different from the new school numbers at high valuations. Yeah, all over the map. Why are the numbers all over the map? It's all because of volatility. Volatility kills. People have to learn about volatility. This is the secret of a successful stock investing. If you understand volatility, you can be prepared for it and you can live through it. If you put your head in the sand, which is what passive investors do about volatility, they just say, I don't want to know. I'm sticking with the same stock allocation. I don't want to know. You'll get killed. Sooner or later, says Rob Bennett. All right. Point five. I don't have time to go into this, but it affects the political scene, the return sequence. You know, a lot of people are saying now we don't know what's going to, you know, is healthcare going to pass or not? Well, one thing that may affect it, it's now late August. It may be coming up for a vote in September, October, November. I don't know. When it comes up, if the stock market has gone down, that may affect the result. And if the stock market continues up, that may affect the result as to the public mood, which may affect how one or two lawmakers votes, which can make the difference. And that's determined by the return sequence. So, you know, the stock market affects the political environment, and the political environment affects the stock market, and the return sequence has a role there. It affects, point six, it affects consumer confidence and therefore economic recovery. One return sequence might get us out of this crash if it restores consumer confidence. Another return sequence might cause a Great Depression. And I personally think the return sequence we're seeing is a very evil one. Because what's happening is we're seeing stock prices go up too quickly, way too quickly, way too quickly. We have not emotionally recovered from the passive investing era. And to have stocks go up as much as they have in recent months is setting us up for a big fall. And that could be a crushing emotional blow to middle class America, I believe. So I think the return sequence we're seeing is scary. It's setting us up for a second big crash of 50% or more. And I think that could be devastating. It, you know, it scares me. 7.7, the return sequence affects volatility and therefore it affects risk, according to some definitions. Some people define stock risk as volatility. I don't totally agree with that definition, but if you go by that definition, then the return sequence determines how much volatility is. So that tells you right there that the return sequence matters. Point eight, it causes great confusion over how stock investing works. Stock investing would be so simple if we got that 6.5 every year. What valuation-informed indexing is really all about, it's trying to simplify investing so that people can understand what's going on. And what I try to do is really treat it as if your return was always 6.5 real. It's not in a nominal sense. You know, the Dow doesn't go up by 6.5 real every year. But in a real sense, that's really what's happening. The economy is generating the productivity needed to justify a 6.5 real return every year. So what I believe is that investors should think about what's really going on, focus on what's really going on instead of the nominal craziness, which is just a sideshow. And if you do that, it makes everything so much clearer. And it helps you to be so much more confident, which makes you a successful investor. Successful investors are investors who have a clear understanding, a clear grasp of the ABCs of stock investing, and who have confidence. The confidence needed to stick with their strategies for the long term. Passive investors, in my opinion, do not have that. The reason they don't have it is they are fooled by the surface events. They're fooled by the volatility, the short-term volatility. They don't see through it. And the goal of valuation-informed indexing is to generate tools that help you to see through it. Excuse me. Point 10, it gives, return sequences give false leads, Ray, the long-term value proposition. Well, the point here is something that frustrates me is that we always talk about the long-term value proposition of stocks at passionsaving.com. And, you know, that's determined by the price you pay for the stocks you buy. But people get thrown. They get thrown. What we're really talking about is stock cycles, which means secular bull markets and secular bear markets. You don't want to be buying stocks at times of high prices because high prices lead to secular bear markets, and that's where you get wiped out. You do want to be buying stocks at low prices because low prices lead to secular bull markets, and that's where you make so much money in a short period of time that you never need to work again. So you have to know, are we heading into a secular bull? Are we heading into a secular bear? And the only signal I know of is are prices insanely high or are prices insanely low? When they're insanely high, you've always got a massive bear coming. And when they're insanely low, you've always got a massive bull coming. But people get thrown by this short-term stuff. You know, we're now in a short-term bull market, but we're in a secular bear market. What matters is the secular bear. That means prices are more likely to go down than they are to go up in the long term. But people are looking at, you know, what's going to happen next month. And they're getting all caught up in this euphoria, which sets them up for a fall. And so we'd be better with a different return sequence, you know, a less misleading return sequence. The return sequence is playing right into the psychological deficiencies of the passives. The passives desperately want passive to work. They don't want to acknowledge, you know, having gotten it wrong. And look what's happening. Their faith was shaken. There were a lot of people questioning buy and hold back in November, December, January, February. And that's still going on today. But prices have gone up enough in recent months that the passives are starting to say, hey, maybe we thought we were wrong, but maybe we weren't wrong. Maybe we were wrong about being wrong. I don't think they were wrong about being wrong. But this short-term bull market is fooling them. And the short-term bull market is one of the possible return sequences that we knew was a possibility all along. But it's a dangerous possibility. Again, if you see it for what it is, if you see it for what it is, a short-term bull, it's not going to hurt you. If you bought stocks, you know, at the low PE10, they went to 12. It's a very appealing P10 level. If you bought stocks at a P10 level of 12 and now they're at 18, if you understand that this is just a temporary bull, you're not going to get hurt. Stocks might fall back to 12. So what? If you bought at 12 and they rose to 18 and they fell back to 12, guess what your return is? 6.5 real. That's not bad. So if you see through what's going on today, it's not going to bother you. The risk, I'm pointing out the risk because a lot of people don't see it. The passives don't see it. And if it falls to 12, a lot of the passives are going to panic. They're going to say, oh no, I thought passive worked, and then I thought I was wrong, and then I thought I was wrong about being wrong, and now I think I'm wrong about being wrong about being wrong. And they're just going to give up and throw in the towel, and they're going to sell at a low price, and they're going to, you know, hurt themselves. If you see through it, it won't hurt you. But you've got to see through it. Say you bought at 12, now we're at 18, and now we fall to 8. So you don't have 6.5 real return. You got less. You had a loss. Still not bad. Why is that not bad? Because if you fall to 8, that turns the most likely 10-year return up to 15. So you're going to make it back in a couple of years. Don't worry about it. But if you bought at 18, you know, if you buy today, it's a little different. Because if you buy today and you fall to 8, you've got a loss of more than 50%. That's a pretty strong hit. Now, you might make it back in 10 years, but you're going to be down for a long time, potentially. You might not be able to last. So if you're talking about buying a small amount of stocks today, that's not going to hurt you. But if you're talking about putting a lot in, and especially if you've already lost a lot in the last crash, if you're in those circumstances, you don't want to be seeing another big loss. So those are my thoughts on the significance of the return sequence. If you have questions or comments, I hope you'll send them along to me. Look for the Contact Rob button at the left side of every page of the website. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.